even for those of us who are in enterprise data management or started out in enterprise data management, right? Like we're still talking about like data governance and data hygiene and integrity and accessibility and privacy and like PII. None of those things have been solved for. To a certain point, like they won't be solved for. It's that leaky faucet that never really gets fixed and it just continues to leak, and then people just decide to live with the noise and with, you know, the small puddle of water. Which is unfortunate because I really do think that there are right courses of action.
Welcome back to the Data Bytes podcast, everyone. I am so excited to be with a powerhouse in the world of data and AI and someone who knows the C-suite really, really well and now is out there helping us all learn about it, how to succeed in it, and really take ownership of where, how, and where we're leading our teams. Sol Rashidi is an esteemed executive leader. She's an influencer in the AI and data space. She helped launch IBM Watson back in 2011. So she definitely has her hands on in the dirty AI deployments for numerous years. And she has been awarded many different awards, 50 Most Powerful Women in Tech, Top 100 Innovators in Data and Analytics, CAO of the Year, CDO of the Year, Global Data Powerhouse. Her accolades go on forever. But what I really encourage each of you to do is go check out her new book, The AI Survival Guide, Scraped Knees, Bruised Elbows, and Lessons from Real-World AI Deployments. So welcome to the Data Bytes podcast. I've been looking forward to this for a while because it's difficult to find people who have so much hands-on experience working in AI. I think everyone right now is an AI influencer or AI expert. I saw a great meme the other day and I love it. Here's the thing, you know, like get your hands in, you know, go, if that's what you want to do, go be it, do it, right? I'm supportive of that. But to talk to someone who has led massive scale deployments for so long, I'm really curious your thoughts and opinion on all of the AI hype. How is it affecting the C-suite, particularly those CDOs, CAO positions? Is this going to be good for them, or is it almost hurting them in the fact that everybody's looking at the shiny object and we still don't have our data governance in order?
Thank you, Sadie. Thank you so, so much. Super exciting to be here. I know, it's so sad. Like even for those of us who are in enterprise data management or started out in enterprise data management, right? Like we're still talking about like data governance and data hygiene and integrity and accessibility and privacy and like PII. None of those things have been solved for. To a certain point, like they won't be solved for. It's that leaky faucet that never really gets fixed and it just continues to leak, and then people just decide to live with the noise and with, you know, the small puddle of water. Which is unfortunate because I really do think that there are right courses of action to take. But the data's never really been in great shape. It doesn't stop you from building a great data product or a digital product or an AI capability. You just have to set expectations and start with a data set that's in better shape than another. And like those are approaches that I've taken along the way. I'm like, I'm not going to pick a use case that fundamentally has a reliance on a data set or a data domain that either one, I can't access at scale, or two, is of like crappy hygiene. Nothing's going to be great. Some things may be good. I'm okay with okay, but definitely not bad hygiene. But you raise an interesting question. And I think and I hope that the role of the CAIO, right, which is another CXO that just got added to the mix, doesn't take the same turn as the CDO. You know, when I took on the role of Chief Data and Analytics, Chief Data and AI Officer in 2016, I've had three posts since then: Chief Data Officer, Chief Data and Analytics Officer, and Chief Analytics Officer. Like I used to be very, very proud of that title. I worked really hard. I was that practitioner that like just, it felt like I clawed my way through the top. And I was so, so happy to hear that our space actually got a seat at the table, which was wonderful. And in some organizations, I really did have a seat. In some organizations, it feels like I had a name tag at the seat, but I really wasn't allowed to have a seat. So different cultures have different impacts, but I would say the biggest thing around this new role, and I hope going back to the CDO roles, the division of labor is really unclear right now between the chief information officer, the chief data officer, the chief digital officer, the chief AI officer, the chief analytics officer. And one thing that I've always talked about is how, you know, the chief data officer is responsible for data, yet everyone has a dependency on data, yet the information officer owns all of infrastructure. So if you can't own platforms and systems that fundamentally force good hygiene because of the way you systematically configure it that forces a good business process, how can you proactively solve those challenges? Or if data accessibility is one of your capabilities, because you need to democratize data for self-service analytics, but you don't own data architecture or the platforms or the accessibility layer, how do you even enable that? So it's really, really hard because the division of labor is not clear. All of those roles depend on infrastructure. All of those roles depend on data. And so where one role starts and the other stops, Demetrios and I were just talking about this on MLOps, is really, really unclear. He's like, if you imagine it, the chief AI officer is what? Responsible for the strategy, identification of use cases. But how on earth, and I always say strategy without proper delivery excellence, it's like pure hallucination. What good is a strategy if you can't actually deliver on it? And to deliver on it, if you happen to be dependent on 8 other teams, 3 other peers, like you will increase drag and lag like no other. And that just like the chief data officer did. And then everyone's going to wonder why it takes so long to get a capability out there. And you can't say, oh, because we're matrix, or oh, because we can't make a freaking decision, or oh, because I've been deprioritized because our brands or labels or business of units are of higher priority to the chief information officer. And I have to wait in line until he or she can do this. You can't say that, right? You just kind of got to suck it up, buttercup. And so things just take a really long time to do because you're just waiting in line when you don't own development end to end. So I think we've clouded the situation a bit. I don't think enterprises have truly figured out the division of labor amongst the existing C-suites that are tech-based, but I'm hopeful. I hope for the best with this role.
Yeah, it sounds like in some regards, like you mentioned, we've just clouded the waters a little bit more and set up these new chief AI officers with the same problems that the chief data officers or analytics officers had, but now just added another one in the mix, right? And so part.
Yeah. Yeah. And my favorite line, my favorite line during the interview process, I'm like, okay, so what's the organizational model? I'll ask about scope. And like 3 out of my 4, because I learned on the 4th one, they're like, well, that's why we need you to come in to tell us. And you don't learn your lesson the first time. And you do go in and only to find out that, oh, they're pegging peers against each other. And we're supposed to figure out what my job is. Like, that's not right. That's not right at all.
What do you think the perfect solution, maybe not the perfect, just a better solution than what we're working with now looks like, right? Is it one, you know, combine all those roles that we discussed into one? We can, you know, name it whatever we want. But what does a better solution look like than the one we have now?
Another great question, Sadie. No one's actually ever asked me that, oddly enough, with all the podcasts I've been doing. If I had to carve out what the chief data officer role should do, I think there is an aspect most definitely of enterprise data management, right? So understanding the master data domains, having full scope of product, customer, finance, vendor, because then you can actually oversee quality and hygiene, but also have ownership and authority over the business processes generating the master data, which is a different twist and not realistic. But I think from an EDM perspective, that's what you need to solve for. Then I think from creating data capabilities from data accessibility or self-service analytics or creating data products or making sure the right insights are there at the right time to the right people, you need to own end-to-end, which for me would include the data engineers for the ingestion, the data architects from the conform to the semantic to the enrich later, to the accessibility layer, to creating APIs and microservices, to power any data product or digital product, to UI, UX, and actually product development, but including the data marts, the data warehouses, the data platforms, and the data lakes that house and containerize your information for use of those products and insights. That would be an ideal world because then you have true guardrails around what you own. And in honesty, I think it's actually very, very possible. The role of the CIO is just complex nowadays where you own firewalls, ports, web conferencing, cybersecurity, like integration, storage, like it's complex. I don't think it's much to ask for key data marts, data warehouses, and data lakes to be owned by the chief data officer, because that's where all the information is that generates the insights. So that would be the perfect role and the perfect carve out. And on top of that, there'd be a healthy relationship between the chief data officer and the chief information officer. In some employers, we've been attached at the hip, and with others, like, they just disdain my very existence. And it has nothing to do with me. They just literally, they're like, you took away scope and headcount. I don't like you, period. Like, well, I didn't do it. The company did it, but let's see if I can charm you with honey and not vinegar. And I'll give them an opportunity. I'll be super nice. I'll even give them credit for things at first to kind of see how they respond. And if they're just ding-dongs about it and not nice, and I'm like, all right, game on. and then the rest takes hold. But yeah, I've had some great relationships and not so great relationships.
What's great about this model that you suggested is there's still handoffs. There's still a place for everyone, right? It's, again, like back to that abundance mindset, like, hey, there's plenty for everybody to do here. Don't worry. You're going to have plenty still to do. We still are going to collaborate, but just better definitions and better guide rails.
Totally. That's, yes. Thank you. You know, honestly, if you and I were just head of the helm, I think we'd figure it all out. But you're absolutely right. There is more than enough work to go around. More than enough. Why are we like just battling over silly little things like scope? It doesn't make sense. You're underwater with work as it is. Why would you hate this?
Do you think that CEOs have a big effect on this as well? You know, when we look at companies that are more founder driven and tech led, you know, I think of Tesla, and they just came out with their earnings report and they listed all their products. And at the top of it was, you know, Optimus and the chips that they create and really propose themselves more as this AI company. And it made me just realize that, you know, you have a founder there who's very tech focused and it's still founder led, right? That sees the opportunity in all these spaces. And I don't know how their teams are organized, but I wonder to what effect does the CEO play in this kind of dilemma of who owns what and who's sharing what is part of the problem that a lot of the CEOs we have today don't have the technical literacy needed to really start to manage their management team properly.
I think you can have a successful company with or without a tech-savvy CEO. I think, of course, things totally take shape when you have an Elon Musk or a Sam Altman or, you know, or Satya like leading the helm that have a technology background, because they fundamentally understand it and appreciate it more. Like, that goes without saying. But I think you can be over successful, because I've worked for CEOs. I'll name one. His name was Richard Fain, and he was the CEO of Royal Caribbean. He didn't grow up in the technology. He was in the cruising industry for 30 plus years. He was brilliant at looking around the corner. He could anticipate, or wanted to anticipate, what was happening, where we needed to be digitally savvy, tech savvy, where the investments needed to make. And back in 2015, conversation started in 2014, when digital transformation wasn't really a buzzword yet. He was already hitting the mark, and he's just like, okay, we need to evolve, we need to change, and I want to be the first one to do it in our industry. And so it was like nearly a $700 to $800 million investment over 5 years. So I do think that there is an opportunity for 100% to be just as successful if you're not tech savvy, but it depends on the leader. And if they have that ability to look around the corner and understand that this is just, it's more than an enabler. It's like the backbone to efficiency and driving growth.
So shifting gears a little bit from hands-on experience in the C-suite position to getting into that position. So we've given everybody who's looking to get into that position maybe a little bit of the bad and some of the things that you're going to deal with. But I do not want to discourage anyone from moving to a practitioner to that executive leadership position. And you just recently, or you're collecting signups, because I know it's a live session, for a class that you and Joe will be teaching on how to transition from a practitioner to the C-suite. Tell me a little bit more about that transition, because I think particularly from a technical side of things, right? We're talking about you're in a tech role to transition to the C-suite. That is not an easy like on-ramp that most people just, okay, I went from working hands-on, very black and white, to people, which are not black and white at all. What have been some of your lessons learned in that transition?
First, the goal is not to discourage, but the goal is to go in with eyes wide open. It is not a cakewalk. It is not a honeymoon. But if there's ever a position to create change and have impact, it has to be at the leadership position in the C-suite, which is why I even clawed my way up there. Because I was tired of being a practitioner and being dismissed. And so I was like, I want a seat at the table. There's no reason why my voice doesn't matter just as much. And I understood the business and I got there. Second, don't wait for it to happen to you. Like, you have to put yourself in positions where you increase the probability of it happening, or you have to actually ask for it and not back down. You do have to pursue it, period. I think the third of it is, it's outside of influence and then finally being there. It's not like you can just walk in and talk data and everyone will hear you because you now have the title. It's actually just the opposite. You're the new kid on the block. You have so much to prove. And so you've got to understand their tone, how they talk, their quote unquote language around strategic initiatives and outcomes and business value and their metrics and KPI. I received my MBA from Pepperdine. I felt like I was getting my MBA all over again the first time I was in those meetings. And I took notes ferociously. Like, I was constantly circling KPIs and metrics, Googling it. It's like, what the heck does this mean? And then writing down like words that they were consistently using in quotes so that it became a part of my language. And then my job was to gel what I knew on the data side with the new language so that I could actually influence and quote unquote articulate business impact. And I think that's something we miss. No one coaches you on that as a practitioner. No one tells you, you have to get to know their side in order to influence and make an impact on your side. And I tripped up. I just went in there saying, you know, data is important and here's why it's important. And it was falling on deaf ears. I think the second is, you know, the higher up you go, the less it is about your IQ. No one wants a smart ass in the room. No one wants a smarty pants whatsoever. It has so little to do with what you know, the higher up you go. And I would say it's less about your IQ and more about your EQ, your SQ, your BQ, your social quotient, your ability to hang with them and have fun, your business quotient, your ability to speak their language and understand their terms, and your emotional quotient, knowing where agendas are hidden, who has what relationships, which executives are allies versus which executives behind the scenes are not. How to align yourself so that you can get things on either side. Like, it's just constantly a game of chess. You have to be very, very good at chess, and I was not. So those are things that, like, you just kind of learn along the way.
Which, if you think of it from someone coming from more of a technical practitioner role, it's almost complete opposite of what you practice and learn to rise up as a practitioner. So how do you, is there any way to be able to get that practice still in the practitioner role, knowing, hey, I want to move into this position? Or do you just have to kind of dive in and, as you say, claw your way to the top?
Nothing teaches you more than failed attempts. Unfortunately, I learned by failing. You can read all the books you want. What I absorb through articles and books is not how things play out when you're actually applying it on the field, is what I call it. Different environments, different players, different cultures. One set of rules. It's not apply once and it'll work consistently. There's so many different nuances. So I hate to say it, but you may screw up a few times, but you got to start practicing now. And whether you're a practitioner trying to convince your manager that you need the following tool to do your job, right? Or whether you're a part of a team and you've been tasked with a project, and you've got an influence, an epic, and a certain feature and functionality because one's going to create more business value than the other. You got to start practicing how you're going to tell that story. Or whether you get into a position, which is how I started, where you have to be the translator between the two worlds and you're put in a position to articulate, like, this is why we're doing X so that you can get Z. Start practicing now, because when those opportunities come and you ask for it, you won't be starting from scratch.
Yeah, I love what you said before, which is using honey versus vinegar, because when I first moved into my first leadership position, I was definitely more of a vinegar person than a honey person. And it took some definite times of me falling on my face thinking all the same mistakes, right? I have the title now. I'm smart. I'm coming in with logical arguments, right? I think that you're in an executive position, so you also will have logical arguments, to realize that no, it does not work that way, and that your social capital is worth so much more than your actual knowledge capital.
It is everything. And I think I mentioned like how I always open every position being uber nice to the CIO, letting them know that, hey, regardless of how you feel about the position, don't take that reflection out on me. I'm an individual. I came into this role. The company decided to make this investment. And I will always try and be very transparent and honest and nice and kind. I'd like to think I'm funny, you know, like, but if they do not respond, and I give them the benefit of the doubt once, then twice, I have absolutely no issues on stopping that honeypot from dripping anymore. I'm like I said, game on. And there are some people who are like that, and so be it. But yes, I originally went in with vinegar and I was like, oh boy, this isn't working. Then I switched it over to honey, and then I made it like my natural state until I get some buggers that are just really jerks. And then I have absolutely no issues in turning, you know, the honey faucet off.
I think that's important for many, just to not get burnt out in certain situations. But I'm also curious to hear your opinion on why you think we see so few women in these leadership positions.
I think there's one, I think we seek approval and we need validation and approval for whatever reason more than our counterparts. I think for us, it's not about progress necessarily, but about being liked. I never got progress by being popular. And it's interesting because in all my positions, I was loved by many and I was hated by many. But I never really cared. For me, it was like, this is what we set out to do, and we're going to show up and we're going to do a great job of doing it, and nothing is going to beat us. And whether it's a success or not, whether there's massive adoption or localized adoption, we're going to build the best darn product or capability we can. And if folks got in the way, I would try and work with them. I would try and collaborate with them. But to a certain point, I always had boundaries. And I think with most women, one, I'm not sure they've set up the proper boundaries for themselves. But two, we're afraid of being called aggressive versus being assertive. We're afraid of having a strong point of view because some people may call us names behind our back. I think we're afraid of leaning in sometimes and standing up and saying, no, actually, this is what we need. And I disagree with that, because they just don't have that backbone. And sometimes they rely on that wishbone. You know, and I don't disagree necessarily with that, because we walk a very, very fine line. Like, you know, there's a stat that women get paid less just fundamentally. And I'm like, is it because we get paid less, or is it because we don't negotiate as well? You know, I don't know how many HR teams have come to me with a proposal and I'm like, I'm worth more. And I'll go back. I'm like, this is great. However, I'd like to make the following adjustments. I know you guys put a ton of time and effort into this and I greatly appreciate it. But based on X, Y, and Z, I'm worth A, B, and C, and I'd like us to reconsider. I don't know many women who are willing to do that. So I just think stepping up to the plate and taking the first swing is the hardest. And for some reason, we're just apprehensive about it.
And what has been the response when you typically do go back to the table and say, hey, this is my worth, or these are my boundaries? Was there a negative pushback, or was it maybe not as bad as we make it up to be in our mind before we actually do it?
I try and do it with utmost appreciation, so it doesn't feel like I'm being entitled. So I'll always end up with, you know, this is great. Thank you so much. I know you guys put a ton of time and thought into it. Like, I'll always do that. And I do it probably more than maybe my peers who are males would do it, but I have to open it up and thank them and understand that I'm very grateful. And then it's kind of like, however, so I'm very, very cautious of my wording on emails. I'm very cautious of my wording in dialogue, so that it strikes the balance of between I have a point of view and I have boundaries and I think I'm worth this, but I'm also very thankful and I want to be able to work and collaborate with you. And that's really hard to strike. I would say I was aggressive the first few times I did it. Of course, I still got it, but I was aggressive. I could have been more graceful with it. I'm a lot more graceful now, but I don't back down from negotiation.
And I will add for individuals too, tools like ChatGPT are a great help. If you put in, right, hey, this is what they're offering me. This is what I want. These are why I think it can help you shape that argument in a way that you may not have the skills to do as well. So I was just pointing people out, like, at least even just start there, even if you don't send it, but at least start with like, what would be my argument for why I should have more?
Sadie, I can't even count how many times I've written the nasty grand email just to get it out because I am just so frustrated. And I'm like, again, seriously, how many times do we need to go back to the objectives? How many times do we need to keep circling around this topic? Let's just get on with it. And I will write that email like as a therapeutic, cathartic, like release in ChatGPT. And I will say, now change this tone so that it's professional yet stern and blah, 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 blah. So I get my catharsis out, but yet, of course, I can't send it that way. And I have ChatGPT completely change the tone of it. Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. That may be the best thing ChatGPT can be used for, which is just the like, make me sound nice filter. Yeah, help me get to my real point versus my emotional turmoil that I'm going through.
100%. And no one should be the on the other end of this. So thank you for giving me a user interface that allows me to just blah.
Exactly. No, I completely agree. And I just think there's, I don't know, we don't have too many excuses now, particularly I would say like women in the Western world in particular. I mean, also just given the amount of laws that we have and the tools and the support systems that we have available, like it is all ready for you to go and to claim your place and to stand up and speak and say, hey, like, this is what I want. And, you know, just, I love what you said, which is like, hey, I'm not going to stop until I get it. Like my team is going to succeed. We're going to go after it wholeheartedly. And I think there's something really beautiful about when you put like your full heart and soul into something that like, no matter even if you still fail, like, you know, you put your all into it. Like there's something so beautiful about that where it's like, whatever happens outcome, I can feel good about myself that I put everything on the table.
100%. Like if you don't put it all out there, you're always going to be left wondering what could have been, what you could have got. It's like we never held back as kids when we came up with a Christmas list for Santa. Why on earth would we hold back now? What conditioned us to not go for it, right? So I say go for it. What's the worst that can happen? They say no.
Yeah, we need to, that's a whole nother this. I'm unfortunately am not a therapist, but that's a whole nother conversation of unprogramming and reconditioning. You know, I've noticed just a difference when I will even use different words. So one of the exercises I do with some of my mentees is like create a vision for your life. And I notice that when they come back with these visions, they're very small, right? And I'm like, this is a vision, right? Like, this is like unimaginable. If this could happen, what would happen? And I've noticed that even just for myself and for my mentees, sometimes just changing some of the words instead of like vision, like what is like your imaginary life, you know? And back to that childhood, right? Play pretend, right? If you could just have a pretend life right now, what would it be? And just even sometimes shifting some of those words can really help to get into the mindset of like, what would I really ask for if I wasn't afraid?
I'm wondering if anyone's ever gone through the exercise of making that list. When did I not ask for what I wanted and what was the consequence versus when did I ask for what I wanted and what was the consequence as like a way of developing that muscle to ask for what you want. I don't know why. I've always been bullish. I've never had issues asking for what I wanted. I think growing up, like I was very much underestimated. I was very much the ugly duckling. I was very much like the last to be picked at dodgeball. So I grew up with like a complex of just not being good enough. And then something switched in me and I'm like, F-U-C-K it. I'm just, if no one's doing it for me, I'm just going to do it for myself. And like, I just turned the knob from off to on. And I haven't turned it back off again. Well, as Jill likes to call it, it's a feature and a bug at this point in time.
And I don't think there's any reason to turn it back off, right? We want to leave that on. Yes, depends on who's using it, right? And who's on the other end of it. Well, I'm curious what's next for you. I mean, you've had such an amazing career working at Fortune 500 companies. Right now, you have the launch of your new book, and I'm sure going on this massive book tour. As you mentioned, all the hard work starts now of going out and talking about it and promoting it. What's on the horizon that you're excited about?
Well, I think for once, it's exciting and it's scary. I'm not under the restrictions or the shackles of enterprise. So I don't have to get permission to speak. I don't have to get permission to write. I don't have to get permission to be out there. And that's very free and liberating. So I'm catching up, which is, I'm so sorry for everyone who's listening. You guys have probably seen me on a ton of podcasts and you're like, all right, already, it's enough is enough. But like for me, I've been so busy doing the work and asking permission to share the work, which, you know, the response is always no, that now I get a opportunity and a chance to evangelize the work that's been done, what's worked, what hasn't worked. I think the second is, you know, I've been writing decks my whole life. Like, give me another, I'm a pro at writing and creating decks. Now I get to create content, right? To fill in the dots and not just the narratives followed by bullet points. That's a little bit fun. And it's flexing a creative muscle in me that I didn't know I had, but I like thinking through problems and leapfrogging to what's around the corner. I am teaching a course on Maven. So Joe and I are co-hosting one of how to actually pivot from practitioner to a leadership role. C-suite or not, it doesn't matter. You could be a VP at a startup, managing a team of, you know, 40 engineers. Doesn't matter. What does that pivot take? What do you got to be prepared of? What do you got to be, like, you know, sufficient in that you're just not learning as a practitioner? Being a really good practitioner is not being a really good leader. They're just two totally different skill sets. So the course is great. I'm still consulting and advising. I'm really loving working with a bunch of startups and scale-ups because I get to get close to the solution. And I think people are building some brilliant things, but that connection to an enterprise playbook or commercializing it isn't there. So I'm helping with them with that. Long story short, it's my first year out. I'm 9 months post retirement / recovery. It's my year of yes. I'm exploring a bunch of things. And yes, this book came out in my year of yes. I got the deal. I wrote it. I published it. Now I'm marketing it. So yeah, that's where we're at. It's pretty exciting.
It sounds like an amazing place to be. I love just the term a year of yes. I think that's such a great and empowering space to be. And I'm so excited to see what comes out. And most importantly, grateful that you're taking the time to actually share all the amazing work that you've done. I think people are hungry for it and ready for it. And I'm excited to see just how many people it helps. So thank you so much for taking the time to come and share on the podcast today. Likewise. And a big thank you to our listeners. Remember to stay curious and keep learning. And we'll catch you next time on the Data Bytes podcast. Bye-bye, everybody. If you are enjoying the conversations you are hearing today, we encourage you to continue to be a part of the conversation and join a community of like-minded, extraordinary women. With our free community membership, you're stepping into a realm where learning, networking, and growth are at the heart and soul of what we do. Connect with Women in Data's global community and network with our chapters all for free. But why stop there? Upgrade your membership with a special offer for Data Bytes listeners by getting $20 off a pro membership in which you'll receive access to over 300 classes, leadership training, and exclusive events. If you're interested in mentorship and networking, we've got you. From monthly thought leadership webinars to exclusive networking events and a diverse on-demand mentorship program, the connections you'll make here are boundless. Join us and be part of a vibrant network. Dive into our book clubs, growth groups, and industry-focused gatherings. Women in Data is not just a community. It's a movement, a place where innovators, changemakers, and leaders come together to shape the future. Visit womenindata.org to join or use the special discount code in the show notes. Together, let's drive change one data byte at a time.